Well, thanks, Patrick. I thought I'd get an idea from people, if I could, about how many of you had not seen the film JFK. That's a few here. I thought it might be useful for us. We had got a slide projector and a VCR tonight to go through a little bit of the visual evidence. And I handed you out this piece done by Wendy Govier, the woman that I'm currently connected to and living with for some years. And she is a news graphic journalist. And there's slides from this news graphic she did about 2 years ago to explain some of the basics of the single bullet theory and the Kennedy assassination discrepancy. So since a lot of you have seen JFK, you've seen the visual evidence at least once. I have some slightly different stuff. We'll go a little bit slower, but try and get that over. The other topics I wanted to cover tonight were some of what I call the deaths of democracy. I say plural because John F. Kennedy's assassination is only the beginning of hundreds of murders and political assassinations in this country that go right up to the current day. And then to talk a little bit about who did kill Kennedy and who I think carry these things out and what the history, hidden history of control in the United States is and sort of who's in charge. So we'll try and do all this within a reasonable amount of time and have some questions. And afterwards, there's also materials, as I'm sure many of you have noticed. The ones over at the far end of the table are handouts, and the others are articles and books that are put out by and tapes by Prevailing Winds Research, which does an excellent job of collecting materials from various researchers and getting them out, and has been working to bring me around. In a recent showing of Hamlet, with Mel Gibson, there's a line in there I liked where he said, foul deeds will rise, though all the acts of men o'erwhelm them to human eyes. And I think the foul deeds, starting November 22nd, 63 at least, are visible to human eyes if you'll take the time and effort to look. I spent many years looking at it in great detail and read the documents. Stone's film has crossed over to a post-literate generation, and a generation in many cases born after Kennedy was killed, who don't have as vivid memory as people in my generation or older have of where they were the moment that Kennedy was shot and the significance politically and socially of what the impact of that was on them. In fact, there's only four people I could ever find in any record who could not remember where they were or have said they couldn't remember where they were at the time Kennedy was shot. One is Richard Milhouse Nixon, who for 13 years, he told the Warren Commission he didn't recall. 13 years later, came back to him. He had been in Dallas, Texas that day. He had also been a lawyer at the Pepsi-Cola Bottling Company convention and with Don Kendall, and he had been at meetings all week with the Murchison oil family and J. Edgar Hoover there in Dallas that I believe were in part planning meetings by one segment of the groups that we'll talk about later who killed Kennedy. Another is Richard Helms, Deputy Director of the Central Intelligence Agency, involved in many of the covert operations for a long time. We know from other reports that he was at Bobby Kennedy's house when they were outside at the swimming pool, and Hoover called to tell Bobby that his brother had been shot. And I believe Helms can't remember because he doesn't want us to know he was there listening, like an ear for the government, to the reaction of the Kennedy family at the point when they get this news from somebody they had lost no love for. In any case, a third person who couldn't remember for a long time and now tells several stories about it is E. Howard Hunt, whose Cuban Revolutionary Council was intimately involved with the Bay of Pigs and the anti-Castro Cubans that Lee Harvey Oswald attempted to infiltrate in New Orleans. And the fourth one that I've heard mentioned that he doesn't know where he is George Herbert Walker Bush, currently President of the United States, I believe, since March 31, 1981, when John W. Hinckley, whose family was very tight financially and socially with Mr. Bush, attempted to assassinate Ronald Reagan, and failing the attempt, I still think Reagan was moved out and Bush has controlled the White House effectively from that point forward. But we'll start with some of this visual evidence and do this slideshow and then get back to the characters and some of the other related deaths. So we can get lights and start the slides. A little too far. That's great. This is an aerial view of Dealey Plaza. At the top middle of the photograph, you can see a building which is the Texas School Book Depository building, from which the official version said all of the shots fatal to Kennedy and wounding Connally came on the sixth floor, just below those arched windows on the top floor, row of windows, and the window to your right. That's the window on the west corner of the building. This is going east out of Dallas. It's right at the edge of town. Three different main streets through the downtown converge at this point, and you see them there looping together under a railroad overpass. And then just beyond, heading up in the upper left-hand corner, is Stemmons Freeway, which would have taken Kennedy's motorcade on that day had he not been shot to the International Trade Mart. So the normal route for the motorcade, and the route originally planned and published in the Dallas papers, was straight down Main Street, the middle street of the three, underneath the overpass going 50 or 60 miles an hour, and then up onto the Stemmons Freeway. The street to the north of Main, curving down, is Elm. That's the street on which Kennedy was shot. This is Commerce Street down to the south. And the street that crosses over all three is Houston, there at the right side of the photo. Along Houston Street at the bottom of the picture, you can see the old Dallas County Records building. There were people in that building who were witnesses. Next to it, the Dallas County Jail, where Oswald was shot in the basement, where Ruby spent his time in prison. Beyond that building is the Daltex building, an office building. Some of the critics believe that shots came from that building. And on the other side of the Texas School Book Depository building, you'll see this round pergola, a concrete abutment. You can see one down here in the lower left corner, a little closer up, but they match each other. And there are concrete things built in there as part of memorializing Dealey Plaza, named after a newsman, Dealey, there in Dallas, who lost no love for the Kennedys. On the left side of that pergola, you'll see a batch of trees, and behind it, you see cars parked in a lot. That lot stretches over to where the railroad track comes in. And along the edge of those trees, going out from the railroad yard and then turning in toward the pergola, that L shape of the trees marks a fence that goes along the back of the parking lot. And the little rise off of Elm Street up to that fence and up to those trees is what's known as the Grassy Knoll. And it's the place where most of the researchers believe that the fatal headshot to Kennedy emerged. There's a great deal of evidence of activity and movement, shots up there. But the official version was somewhat different. So we can go to the next slide. What you'll see here is looking from the south side of Dealey up straight at this building in the middle is the Texas School Book Depository, and the little black arrow is pointing at the sixth floor window of the book depository on that side where the Warren Commission says all of the shots came from back down onto Elm Street. You see the cars running along Elm here, the cab going along at an angle. You can also see in that picture that there are trees, there's Texas live oak that's in the way right underneath the window of a clear shot for some period of time to anybody traveling along the street. And so both because of that live oak and the timing of Kennedy's reactions, he could not have been hit earlier than when he got beyond the doorway of the building and down into this area like where the cab is. And the headshot, given that timing, comes within about 5.6 to at the most 6 seconds after the point that Kennedy's first reacting to a shot. The official weapon that was supposed to have been used from the window can only be recycled, not aimed, but just recycled, the bolt pulled, the shell ejected and put back in a matter of 2.3 seconds. It was fairly sticky. It was from an old gun order house and a batch of Mannlicher Carcanos from World War II. They stopped making the live ammunition for the gun back in the 1940s. And it was in fairly bad shape. You could mail order it for $23. It was more of a collector's piece than a working rifle than anyone would use. It had a scope on it, but the scope didn't relate to where the bullets went. But you wouldn't have had time to aim it anyway, because if you figure there's at least three shots, a bystander was wounded named Tague by a shot that hit the curb. Kennedy's headshot is clearly one shot, that's two. And then if you eliminate all the rest of the wounds down to three, That's all the shots you can get off in that time period. With 2.3 seconds between, you have about a half second left between each shot to aim the gun, which means you're point aiming, you're not scope aiming. And in addition to that, there were three shells ejected, supposedly found up in the book depository floor, from the gun that I believe were planted there in order to implicate the assassin in the window as Oswald. But these shells constituted all the shells that were loaded into the gun. The magazine was empty of shells, so you have to believe that Oswald took this old rifle up there to the sixth floor, and being such a sport, even though he was going to try and hit the president, he took a magazine that would hold six bullets and stuffed three in and let fate decide the rest with this lousy scope and everything else. What you'll see in the next slide is a close-up view of that window. This is about 3.5 to 4 seconds after the assassination. You don't see anybody in the assassin's lair. You might note that the window's open, only open about a foot. Down below, there's two employees looking out of the fifth floor window. They testify to the Warren Commission. They did hear noise up there. They heard shots. They heard what they felt were shells being ejected on the floor. And I do believe people were shooting from that window. The best witness evidence shows two people up in that window, and they may be identified this year. There's a photographic expert named Wilson who's been using a very high level, it's not computer enhancement, but it's a method that allows them to put about 3,500 pixels per square inch and then look at the 253 grayscales in each pixel and identify what's there. And he looked at one of the assassins that most of the critics call a badge man up on the grassy knoll and pulled him up to the point that you can see his left eye and his ear, you can see the rifle scope, and you can actually see the outlines of the badge on his police uniform, including an eagle facing to the left on the badge. And he said that Stone contracted him to look at this window in various photographs and that he has pulled up the faces of the assassins there in the window, and that when they are released, they're going to shock people. Presumably it's not Oswald. But they've got it up to a level where they feel like they could identify it, or at least identify it not as Oswald. But this is also a few seconds after the assassination. There's no gun barrel pointing out the window, which some of the witnesses said after the shot they looked up and saw a gun sticking out, and there's no evidence of anybody there at the window at that time. In the next slide, you'll see Lieutenant Day, this is several days later, holding up the Mannlicher Carcano that they claim belonged to Lee Harvey Oswald. They never established it. They showed that this was sent to a post office box. The box had no signature card to link it to Oswald. The order for the gun was not signed by Lee Harvey Oswald and had a different name on it. And the gun had no prints from Lee Harvey Oswald when it was sent to the FBI, and no evidence of a print being lifted. 3 days after it was sent to the FBI, Day turned in what he claimed was a print taken off of the gun that matched Oswald. Hand. There's no evidence that Oswald owned or ever fired this gun. There was no graphite in his cheek or any paraffin test evidence to show that he shot a rifle that day or any sort of a gun that day. He was, I believe, framed with this gun. A letter was addressed to Lee Harvey Oswald, found in December at the post office there, addressed to him at that P.O. box, but was sitting in the dead letter office. Had he owned the box, I believe it would have gone ahead to his box. Why it would have been cast into letters that couldn't be delivered is only explained when you understand this wasn't Oswald's P.O. box. What's more interesting is that this gun is not the gun described by Seymour Weitzman and others at the time that they searched the book depository. Weitzman owned a gun shop. He was a deputy sheriff in Dallas. He knew guns, and he picked up the gun, and all the other photos at that time of the gun show that it was a German Mauser of a completely different caliber than this gun, different make. And then we're told that this Mannlicher, with this faulty scope, is the assassination weapon, and he's holding it up for the press there, and you can see sort of what a zoo the hallways and byways of the the Dallas Police Department were in those hours and days afterwards. In the next picture, this is some of the news coverage at the time and some of the photos that were printed. At the top right is supposedly the view from the assassin's lair down onto Elm Street. You can see a number of boxes that were planted there, but the original photos of the boxes close up show a different configuration than what's in this photo. and show double-layered boxes that would have made it impossible for anybody to even get near the window. You might also note that the bottom box of the pile is sitting on the floor at the base of the window, and there's the distance of about one or one and a half boxes at most. It's really under 2 feet. It's less than the distance between my feet and my knees up to the windowsill, and then the window was open about a foot. So some witnesses said they saw a man standing and firing from the window, but standing and firing, you'd have to fire through the window, and there was no evidence of that. Somebody would have had to get down on the floor or at least kneel down to a fairly low position to have fired out of that window. And below you see the book depository, and the south side of Elm Street in the front of the photo shows a sewer. This is one of two storm sewers there on Elm at that point. The other is almost directly across the street. And the one across the street on the other side, north side of Elm, is the one where I believe the fatal headshot emerged. I can give you some other evidence, but the importance of this sewer is that while it would have been a good deal behind the motorcade, it was a little further up the street than the other sewer, at least 30 feet behind the motorcade at the time Kennedy was shot. It was right near that sewer that Buddy Walters, one of the deputy sheriffs there in Dallas, and an unidentified FBI man located not only fragments of Kennedy's brain, but a .45 slug, which I think was the fatal bullet to Kennedy. And there's photo sequence, you'll see one of them here later, of this FBI guy picking up this bullet and putting it in his pocket, and the bullet then disappears from any evidence or consideration by the Warren Commission. In the next slide, this is just the New York Times beginning to reprint in full the Warren Commission report when it comes out, and the press fell all over itself in the first few hours and days praising the report before any of them had a chance to read it, certainly before any of them could have considered the evidence related to it. They were already naming it, and many of those same press people are attacking Oliver Stone's film now without having done any of the homework necessary to understand what an accurate movie Stone has done. As we go along here through the slides, you'll see different newspapers right from that day that show us things about it. This is Robert Cutler's drawing, one of the researchers who's also an architect, done in detail of Dealey Plaza, showing the official version of the Warren Commission as to the, at least, location, if not sequence of the shots. The Warren Commission felt it was not necessary to determine whether the shot that they say hit Kennedy in the back of the neck and exited from his throat was the first or second shot, or the head shot was the second or third, or that the shot that hit Tague was the first, second, or third. So that's what all this 1-2-3, 2-3, 1-2, the commission says doesn't matter what sequence they were. There could only have been three shots from the gun, and there could only have been one gunman, so that's what we're left with. The Warren Commission had evidence right at the beginning of five shots. At the Bethesda Hospital, that's at a minimum five shots, the Bethesda Hospital doctors turned the body over and found a wound in Kennedy's back about 5 inches below the nape of the neck. It was not a through-and-through wound. It went into his back and it closed. One of the interns stuck their finger in to probe the wound. It went up to the second knuckle, second joint of the finger there, just about an inch at the most, and closed off. There was no bullet in the wound. There was a bullet signed for by the FBI that rolled out of Kennedy's casket that was delivered to Bethesda Inn, although that bullet never reappears in any of the evidence either. And there was a missile taken from the chest signed for by the FBI at the autopsy, and that bullet also is never accounted for. I found evidence both in the wounds and in the activity there on Dealey and other witnesses that saw bullets, nicks in the road sign and on the sidewalk, of 16 bullets. This bullet in the casket, which I just read about this week, accounts for a 17th bullet in addition to those possibly. But it was a flurry of shots, as Kellerman said, not just these two or three simple shots. The second bullet the Warren Commission knew about was an entrance wound that was really too small to have been a traditional bullet or a bullet of any size or caliber. It was about 3 to 3.5 centimeters in width, an entrance wound into Kennedy's throat, right at the point of the Adam's apple. And that wound was obliterated by a tracheostomy and also by what I consider to be, and you'll see the photos here, a much larger wound made in his neck, I think, to retrieve that. I don't think it was a bullet. I think it was what was known in the intelligence community as a flechette. These are small self-propelled darts. They can carry toxins, and they can be shot with a CO2 cartridge, and I think that flechette came from the right front of the motorcade by the man holding the umbrella, and I think the umbrella was, in fact, a weapon. They developed about 50 of these weapons at Fort Detrick in Maryland, the CIA did, as technical weapons, and I think they had to cut into Kennedy's throat and get that flechette out in order to make sure that nobody found that or it entered any evidence. But in any case, he had a very small entrance wound into his throat and an entrance wound in his back. The Warren Commission, for this purposes, couldn't deal with those two bullets and still end up with both a headshot and tag wounded. You've already got four bullets. In addition to that, Connally is wounded through the chest. His rib is broken. He's wounded through the wrist. His wrist is shattered. And there's, if not a bullet, at least fragments of a bullet in his thigh. And the commission has one bullet to do all of that work. They said the bullet went in the back of Kennedy's neck, came out his throat, hit Connally, went through his rib and his wrist and lodged in his thigh, and then somehow ended up on a stretcher at Parkland Hospital on the second floor, unconnected to the care of Connally or Kennedy, when a man resembling Jack Ruby kicked the stretcher and an intern picked a bullet up that rolled off the stretcher. That bullet became Commission Exhibit 399, or what's known by the critics as the magic bullet, and we'll see pictures here in the following slides. But this is the official Warren Commission version of the one, two, or three shots that did all the damage, one wounding Tag, the bystander, one hitting Kennedy in the head, and one bullet doing the rest. Next. And these are drawings from the graphic that I handed out to you, or you might have picked up down here, showing the official version, and then showing one of the critics' versions of the multiple locations that were likely in order to account for the real wounds and evidence on the scene. So triangulation of fire and multiple shots. And there are a number, of course, sequences. Different researchers have different ideas about where these bullets came from. Next. And this is the full graphic that you have, but you can see the middle section had to do with these shots. This was a news graphic that was sent out to over 500 papers nationally and internationally in a computer network where Wendy works and was picked up in some international papers as well. I think the next slide shows a Spanish language version of it. And that was 2 years ago, and it's been revived now with the Stone film and interest, and several papers have picked it up just in the last month. And we'll see these other lower slides that have to do with the discrepancy in the autopsy and doctor's reports, the direction of the bullets, and also the path of the magic bullet. So you can go to the next one. This is the Spanish language version. They ask who killed President Kennedy, and it says right at the top that American people believe they're being lied to. It's a little more honest than our papers. And they translated all the words. Next. Here's a sequence of pictures. Here's Oswald at the bottom, pro-Russian, held. Johnson being sworn in with Jackie next to him. They dragged her away from the casket for about 5 minutes to go up to the front of the plane, which might have allowed people at that point to pull Kennedy's body out of the casket and off the plane. There's some evidence, which we'll go into later, about the timing that seems to suggest that Kennedy did not go back on Air Force One and, in fact, arrived ahead of time. But in this sequence, in the swearing in, she was forced to come forward. The rest of the time, she stuck with the casket all the way to the Bethesda Hospital. Next. These are headlines right at the time. Here's the Washington Post. Johnson being sworn in. Tragic flash from Dallas. And this coverage. But in almost all of them, they talk about Oswald being pro-Castro or pro-Red. Next. Mrs. Oswald goes back to the hospital, and they have these various pictures of her with Robert Kennedy and in shock at the situation. A Marxist is accused. All of this was red smear on Oswald, who was an intelligence agent for the United States, who had made a phony defection to the Soviet Union and was the farthest thing in the world from a Marxist. In fact, everyone he knew in Dallas had anti-communist sympathies and were among those who were the least likely to embrace a Marxist. Next is yet another headline. This is the Dallas Morning News. Johnson becomes president. But almost right away, they have this information out saying that that Johnson's the president and who the assassin is. Go ahead. This is a picture of Oswald and a number of people that he says he hired from the hiring hall, the unemployment office, to hand out these leaflets for the Fair Play for Cuba Committee, and they're in front of the International Trademark Building in New Orleans. Get the significance of that a little later, but International Trademark was owned by the corporate firm that organized the assassination of John F. Kennedy. And behind him, with his arms behind his head, is Carlos Bringuier, who worked at the Anti-Communist League of the Caribbean. He's about to stage a fight with Oswald here, and Oswald's arrested and taken into jail. And then the two of them come on and debate about Oswald being a Marxist and him and Bringuier being an anti-Castro Cuban. But this was all staged for the benefit of creating a left cover on Oswald. And Oswald is out there. And Bringuier and Oswald worked in the same building there in connection with this individual, Guy Bannister, from Navy Intelligence and the FBI. So Oswald's doing his intelligence work, but posing as a leftist, and Bringuier, part of the anti-communist element, comes out to stage a fight here. Next slide. We'll show that, again, you have the person charged with the slaying. That just within, it's interesting, if you want to look at his shirt here, you'll see in a minute we have a blow-up of a guy standing in the doorway to the book depository. It's actually in the picture on the upper left, known as the Alkins photo. It's one of a series of photos. We never got to see all of them. Many of them were cropped like this. This isn't the full photo. But when you do see the full photo, you can place the timing of where the car was. Kennedy has already been hit. If you look closely, you can see Jackie's gloved hand through the windshield up to Kennedy's arm and Kennedy's cuff. He's reacting to the shot. His hands are up to his throat. He's already been hit. And there's an individual standing sort of back where the Secret Service are looking back to the doorway, on the left side of the doorway. And as we blow it up, you'll see how much that shirt looks like the shirt of the Oswald down here in the Dallas jail under arrest at the press conference. Next. Here's yet another blow-up of Altkin's photo, getting a little closer on the guy in the background. One of the things that happened when the shots began is that the Kennedy car, against all Secret Service precautions and rules and training, the driver hit the brake and slowed from about 28 miles an hour to under 5 miles an hour. I was just on a panel at American University with Henry Gonzalez, a representative from there in Texas, who was in the motorcade and told me it was the first time he'd ever been in a downtown motorcade that went under 30 miles an hour in Dallas. Because they didn't go down Main Street, but 48 hours ahead of time changed the route of the motorcade to take a right turn on Houston and then a left turn on Elm and go back down Elm, it slowed the motorcade down to about 20 miles an hour. And then at this point, he's hit the brake. And the first way you see it is how close, you see the distance between the Secret Service and the next car. And this car has hit the brake, and the other car is starting to run up into the back of it. And most of the Secret Service guys are looking around because they've already heard a shot. And he kept applying the brake and slowed down to about 5 miles an hour. You can also see, and then Kennedy's hit in the head, and then he speeds up. You can see to the right of the motorcade, and there's two more on the other side, two motorcycle police. At the time of Kennedy's headshot, the one closest, Billy Hargest, closest to the car, was splattered with brain matter and blood, which went back into the left so hard that he got off the motorcycle. Even though he had his jacket on, he thought he'd been hit, and walked over to one of the bystanders and said, "Am I hit?" It was covered with blood and brain matter, and the skull fragments had spun off at such a rate and smacked his jacket that he thought he'd been hit with a bullet. Next. This blows up the guy in the doorway. Again, as I mentioned, look at the shirt, cut, and the rolls in the collar match. They say that this is a guy named Lovelady in the Warren Commission, and Lovelady said he was wearing a short-sleeved shirt that day, not this shirt that matches Oswald's, that had red and white stripes running down it. There were about 7 witnesses that saw Oswald here on the first floor watching the motorcade or up on the second floor during the time preceding, during, and right after the motorcade. The elevators were in the basement. The only way down from the sixth floor was a stairwell where 2 women said no one went past them when the police caught up with them. A policeman ran into the building having heard shots and commotion of pigeons up on the top floor. This patrolman Baker got off his motorcycle and ran into the building up to the second floor and saw Oswald through a window drinking a Coke, and on the basis of that, even though he'd heard the shot much further up, kicked in the door of the snack bar and ran in and stuck his gun into Oswald's stomach at which point Roy Truly, the manager, said he's all right, he works here, and the cop backed off. But there's nothing to explain anything suspicious or any reason why he'd go after Oswald. It wasn't like he was running or was anywhere near where he heard the shot, but I think many of the Dallas police were given photos of Oswald and told to pick Oswald up that day, but this was too soon. They didn't want to take Oswald out of the book depository. He was to go on instruction to the Texas Theater to be not only picked up but killed, and the police then drew the pistol that had been sent to the P.O. box, and were going to kill him with that pistol and stick it in his hand, and Oswald, I believe, reached out and put his fingers into the breech of the pistol and stopped it from firing. And that's how he got a little bit of graphite on the web of one of his hands, was from that gun. And the gun couldn't go off, and they were unable to kill him. Then they had to take him out and question him. 48 hours, they came out in this key political crime. They had not one note recorded. They had no tape recording. They said, Captain Fritz said, we know what he said. But what he said was too much. He knew too much. He said that he was a patsy, and he said that they had framed him, and he began to give the evidence. And rather than have a trial or any further public exposure, it was important to go in and have Jack Ruby, who worked with intelligence and the mob, kill Lee Harvey Oswald before he could speak. This is next. So I believe Oswald was a patsy, was innocent of the crime, didn't own the guns, and didn't fire any guns that day, just as he said. And here's Ruby, this club owner, down in the basement of the Dallas jail, jumping out to shoot Oswald. And I believe they waited till Ruby got into place. And if you ever get to see a videotape of this, listen closely to the sounds. The police car backs up nowhere near the double doors, which is against security. It honks the horn and the double doors open, and Oswald comes through with these two police officials. And as they approach the car, the horn honks again, and as if on cue, Ruby jumps out, yells Oswald, and shoots him in the stomach. And then this melee occurs. One of the people there jumps down and pumps Oswald's stomach, forcing blood out, and he's dead within a few hours at Parkland Hospital. Next slide. Could I get the next slide? You'll notice here on the top headline, tip to FBI warned of Oswald's death. Dallas police also got calls warning that Oswald would be killed in the jail. All those were ignored, and Ruby was able to come forward and shoot him. And this sequence, very shocking to the American public, shown on television, was the first clue to many of the first-generation researchers that we were dealing with not a lone nut, but a conspiracy in the case. You know, you'll see Deputy Weitzman in the upper right leaving the building, not with the Mannlicher, but with the Mauser. If you know about guns, the position of the bolts and other things will show you that that's what that is. This is afterwards to the left there. That picture shows the police with all their guns drawn. If you look down to the lower right, you'll see the position of the door in relation to the window where Oswald was standing in the book depository. And on the lower left, you'll see the FBI man, unidentified, reaching down to pick up the bullet. It says there, you know, he stoops to get a bullet. And he next frame, you see him standing up, putting the bullet in his hand into his pocket. Close-up in the same sequence shows that it was a .45 slug. And Deputy Walters, who was with him, bragged that they picked up a .45 slug and brain matter over there on the south side of Elm. This is Life magazine, phony picture of Oswald. Not only is he looking like a leaning tower of pizza there, he's about to fall over, but supposedly a Marxist. They had him hold some communist newspapers in his hand for the photo, but the two papers are the Communist Party Daily Worker and the Socialist Party Militant. I don't know if you have any radicals on campus, but these two people don't sit around and talk to each other much. These are sectarian parties within the left that don't agree. And it's likely an FBI agent would have both copies to read them, but not as likely that you'd be carrying propaganda from both, more likely one or the other. In addition, critics have noted that the shadow underneath Oswald's nose seems to be at noon, while the shadow on the body is at least maybe 1 or 1:30 in the afternoon. And in the next slide, you'll see that this is cover of Life magazine to frame him as the violent assassin. He said when he saw the photo in the jail, they put my head on somebody else's body. In the next slide, you'll see a close-up picture on the left of Oswald in the jail, and the picture on the right of the Life photo, and there just below the shadow of his lip, sort of cutting through the middle of it, is what Jack White and the other photographic experts say is a cut line. matting Oswald's face on top of the neck of somebody else's body. And one thing you can note is the difference in the chins. Oswald has cleft chin, and the chin on this lower one goes straight across. There's another number of other pieces of evidence to show that this picture is fake. It's heading the wrong way for some reason. Still going back. Okay, this is the official autopsy drawing from George Burkhardt, who was the private physician to Kennedy, from his notes taken at the autopsy of what he saw. And you can see there on the right the wound into the back, well below the nape of the neck. And also he describes a small hole as 3.5 centimeters wide in the opening of the throat on the Parkland. But the position here is what's important, of the bullet to the back. It's not high up on the neck. You can also see the scar on Kennedy's back from his earlier wound while he wore a back brace from World War II when he was involved in the PT-109. On the next slide, we have official drawings. This particular one, published by the Warren Commission, done by a Navy guy named Rydberg, attempts to reposition the bullets, to move the bullet in the back up to the neck so that it can course through the neck at a downward angle and come out the throat. Also showing this hole in the back of the head and the side of the head blown out by the bullet. And even though the doctors who saw the wound, and you'll see some of the photos, the doctors at Parkland all described the opposite, a massive exit wound at the back of the head with this flap of the right temple blown off where the bullet came in. These are drawings supposedly taken from the official autopsy photos and the x-rays superimposed by Ida Dox for the House Select Committee on Assassinations. And again, she's moved the bullet hole up, not quite as far as Rydberg has, but well above where it was in the official drawings and the photos, and put the entrance wound in the back of the head. So the House Select Committee continued with the mythology of the Warren Commission and ignored the hard evidence at the scene. And here's somebody measuring, and this is the drawing. I believe Ida Dox's drawing of the, this may be a photo. Yeah, this is a photo. She did fairly accurate drawings. This is a photo from the autopsy. Not an official photo because we don't have any. These were smuggled out, and we only purport to be the photos, and some aspects of them look like they were tampered with, but this again shows this hole fairly far down the back, and they're measuring on the back, although cardinal points were never established and normal autopsy procedures were never followed. What was left of the brain was never serially sectioned, and there was no attempt to really determine the direction of the bullets. They were only allowed to examine this wound in the back for a few seconds, and then they were told to turn the body over. The Parkland doctors didn't see the wound at all. They were trying to save his life while he lay on his back. But here's supporting evidence for the position. Here's the hole in Kennedy's jacket, well below the neck. And the next slide shows the hole in its position in the shirt, corresponding to this. If you want to go to the next one. And clearly shows that the bullet came in well below where the Warren Commission has to place it. On a downward angle from the window, the bullet presumably going in at that point would have gone downward into the chest or through the chest. Unless you say it's deflected by bone, but the shot angled by the Warren Commission and other things, as well as Kennedy's x-rays, show no bone damage in the spine or the trachea. So there's no reason for the bullet to deflect, and if it had deflected, it would have been in different condition itself, exiting the neck, and it would have left a ragged exit wound, not this clean little 3.5 centimeter hole that the Warren Commission says is the exit wound. But the hard evidence, as it's been gotten out by the critics over the years, shows clearly that the official versions seen by the doctors were the correct ones, not the phony Warren Commission version. Next slide shows several drawings, both from the Parkland doctors, their description of the bullet wound in the throat, just above the necktie knot, this small wound, and on the other side from the Parkland, or I'm sorry, from the Bethesda situation, the wound has been opened by a tracheostomy. But a tracheostomy is only a 3/4 to 1 inch wound. This is almost 2.5 to 3 inches across, and that's why I say that apparently this huge gap in his throat, not necessary to get a little tube down the throat. And Mr. Wilson, again, has done photographic and computer work on this picture from the autopsy and has found down into the wound in the throat that they cut open the 3.5 centimeter hole lower down in the wound corresponding to the original doctor's description in Dallas. But this obliterated any real examination of that wound or what was in it by the time the doctor saw it there at Bethesda to do the autopsy. So that bullet was ignored. This is Ida Dox's drawing for the House Select Committee of the hull, but you can see how extensive it is across the front of the neck. Next, picture shows an actual autopsy photo, Kennedy's face, and again the size of this hole in the throat. This is Rydberg's drawing. You have to understand that these Navy drawings from Bethesda were done without benefit of the original autopsy notes, which were burned by Commander Hume at home. And so it's all in his verbal description of the wounds. Rydberg never gets to see the hard physical evidence or the wounds of the body. He just takes these instructions for the drawing from Commander Hume, who was busy botching the autopsy and giving orders for people to stay away once they got the body under military control. And again, he shows this through and through shot, entering at the back of Kennedy's throat and going out the front. Next slide shows Ida Dox's attempt, rather crude, by having the head wiggle forward to posit the idea that a bullet could have gone in at the lower position on the back, and as Kennedy moved his neck forward, come out his throat. But there's no evidence of this kind of movement by Kennedy at the time of any of these shots happening. This then would have to be the path, given the real evidence of the bullet that the commission said did all the work. It's coming downward into Kennedy at the back, ricocheting or turning direction back up to the throat, exiting the throat on an upward angle, and going too far to the left of Connolly to have hit him. So it must turn again and head toward Connolly, back on a new downward angle, and back to the right to go into the back of Connolly's chest at the right and smash his rib. There's a timing discrepancy there because Kennedy's clearly hit at one point that's several seconds before Connolly is clearly hit. Connolly stuck to his testimony over the years, so the bullet has to sit in midair for a few moments and try to decide who the next person it is that it wants to hit. They're about 2.5 feet apart, and then seeing Connolly, supposedly, I guess they have smart bombs, maybe they had smarter bullets back in 63, it goes for his rib and his wrist. There's also evidence, as you'll see in the slides, that the bullet exiting the chest could not have done the damage to the wrist because the wrist is intact for several more frames. And then exiting the wrist, in this official version, the bullet has to turn once more and enter the thigh. What you'll see in the next slides are, from a top view, the angle problems with the bullet. The other problem the Warren Commission would have had they done a real job, was to have followed the bullet backwards at this angle. It's the official angle of the difference between the wounds. And it has to be a minimum from the midline of the body, 28 degrees, in order not to hit bone. If you take that and follow it backwards, it doesn't get anywhere near the book depository building. And if you follow the wound on the upward angle, it doesn't get to the sixth floor. So you can't follow this official version, even through Kennedy's throat, back to the window that it's supposed to have come from, much less make any sense of what it has to do after it gets out to the front. Go ahead. Here's another drawing from the Warren Commission exhibits showing the path of the bullet through Connolly, his chest and his wrist. Suppose you follow that bullet backwards. Kennedy would have to be standing up on the back of the car in order to have that come out of his throat. And there's certainly no evidence that he did so, but everything has to be changed in order to fit this official version of how these bullets went through these two people so that we can make it all happen with a minimum of three bullets. Next. This is in the middle, the actual Commission Exhibit 399, the magic bullet itself. Even the little nick at the top is metal taken out by the FBI for neutron activation analysis and not damage done to the bullet at the time it was found at the stretcher. This bullet, I believe, is completely planted. The two bullets next to it have been fired through bales of cotton. It was flattened a little bit, as if it had. It doesn't even show as much distortion as the other two bullets on either side do, as if it was fired maybe through water or something less resistant than cotton even, and just fired for the purpose of getting it out from a gun, showing they could link it back to the Mannlicher. Next, shows real bullets that have gone through the wrists of cadavers. And this was withheld by the Warren Commission for many years. Fired from a Mannlicher, 6.5 bullets, and you see they don't look at all like CE-399. They look like bullets that have hit bone. Next. These are x-rays of metal fragments left in Connolly's thigh, and the next one I think shows fragments in his wrist. One nurse said she took 4 to 5 fragments out of the thigh. Fragments were removed from the wrist at the hospital. The weight of those fragments alone that were removed is greater than the weight of metal missing from Commission Exhibit 399. So the bullet not only had to do all these tricks, it had to leave more metal behind than it had in it. This is the drawing then, based on some of this evidence, CE-399, the bullets that Wendy did in order to demonstrate the path of the bullet from the other side and all the twists and turns it would have had to take. Next. This is looking down from the book depository window, an official FBI photograph of the supposed scope and shooting through the scope. And as you can see, there's a tree in the way, and it had leaves on it that day in November. And not very good shot. A clear shot would have been to hit Kennedy as he came toward the building on Houston before he made the turn on Elm. But this helps again in the timing to show that the first shot that hit Kennedy, unless it was the one in the back, but any shot from this window would have had to be at a point beyond where this tree is clearly in the way. And then that puts it too early to be the same bullet as the one that hit Connolly, and too late to give the assassin time to fire more than 3 bullets. Based on the descriptions of Parkland, on the left you see a bullet entering the throat and a bullet exiting the back of the head. Then you go to Bethesda, their version is first a bullet entering the back of the head and going out the front, and a bullet entering the back and not exiting. A second, final version after Hume burned the autopsy notes and they had to come up with it to be right, shows the official version with a bullet going all the way through and moved up. Next. This is from the Parkland doctors, Dr. Robert McClellan's version. She agreed to what he saw at Kennedy's head, this massive exit wound at the back of the head there at Parkland. But the official version by Ida Dox and the House Select Committee insists on a bullet going the opposite direction, blowing out the front of the head. In fact, the x-ray photographs that the House Select Committee showed from the situation show a segment of the front of the head missing where even Kennedy's eye socket is damaged. And you could see from those earlier photographs that the front of his face is intact. This is Ida Dox's drawing, the back of Kennedy's head, but close photographic analysis by Wilson and other experts shows that there's a matting line, and what appears to be this bullet hole in the back is actually a hole through a matted bunch of hair or some other material that's been stuck over the actual wound. There's other evidence of forgery in the photograph and followed in the drawing here. See the photograph in a second. And that hand at the top appears to be holding this thing on over the back of Kennedy's head in order to make it match the official story. Look at the photo. You can see a little bit closer that there's a great difference between the bottom, the hair on the bottom of the head, and this flap that they're holding up here. In order to demonstrate, you can also here see the bone fragment on the right that was blown out with a bullet entering the temple. Another autopsy photograph showing this massive damage to the back part of the head. Here's a picture in the Washington Post right after the assassination of Kennedy's car. Clint Hill, against Secret Service orders, to stay with his car, ran forward and jumped onto the back of the car and spread-eagled himself over Jackie and the president, trying to save their lives. At this point, the fatal headshot is gone, and Jackie is also climbing out onto the back. You can just see her arm there beyond him. She's climbing onto the back of the motorcade. 8 years later, we got her secret testimony loose under Freedom of Information Act, and she was grabbing a piece of Kennedy's brain and skull in order to retrieve it, and held onto it all the way to Parkland Hospital. Next. These are frames of the Zapruder film. Kennedy, at this point, has not yet been hit. He's waving. He's in the back of the car. Connally's in front of him. Turn to the right, listen to the crowd. Connally's holding his Stetson hat in the wrist that was shattered. You see Jackie's pillbox hat and the two motorcycle police on the other side of the motorcade. And this is just before Kennedy begins to react to the shot. This is Zapruder was standing up on the little pergola on the top of the grassy knoll, and this Stemmons Roadway sign that you see in the lower right-hand corner got in the way for just fractions of a second while the motorcade disappeared behind the sign in the film. Here they are emerging from the sign. Kennedy clearly now is hit. Connally is not. He's turning at the sound of the shot. He's showing no reaction to anything. Kennedy's already responding and putting his arms up to his throat. His face is in distress. Jackie may or may not have noticed by this point. At the lower left-hand side, you see the ribs of an umbrella, though I believe is one of the weapons. Nobody else has an umbrella open. It's a bright, sunny day. It rained that morning. This umbrella is pumped up and down by this individual on the scene, and then I believe just aimed at Kennedy. Kennedy's throat and causes this reaction that he's having came from the flechette gun, and I'll show a diagram of it that Robert Cutler did soon. Here's Kennedy just a frame later. These are about 18 frames per second, so not much time between these. You can still see the outline of the umbrella clearly as they pass him, and Kennedy responding, but Connally still not hit. He's turned to hear the shot and has begun to turn back to the right. Next. Kennedy's still slumped into the seat by the shot in the back, I believe, and responding to the throat shot, the umbrella disappearing. And Connally, at this point, beginning to react to a shot, his shoulder slightly slumped. But, as you see, the Stetson's still in his hand. His cheeks puff out. This is the full reaction. His hair is mussed. And his shoulder's completely slumped now. He's responding to being hit in the chest. This is about frame 236, and it's well over a second beyond the time of the beginning of Kennedy's reaction when they're leaving the situation. So Kennedy's got his hands up to his throat. Jackie's starting to realize something's wrong. But Connally, as you can see, still holding onto his hat. And here he is starting to turn from the impact, full impact of the bullet. Next slide shows him turned almost completely around, and then he begins to fall backwards into his wife's lap. But even in all these frames, he's still holding the hat, and the wrist isn't hurt. So I think the bullet through his chest is a separate bullet than the bullet through the wrist. And the bullet through the wrist hits him probably from the front much later. This is several frames forward, jump to about frame 312, just before Kennedy's hit by the fatal headshot. Jackie's got her hand on his arm now clearly, and Connally slumped back into Nellie's lap, and Kennedy's starting to tip forward. From this point on, Kennedy is driven back upward and to the left by the next shot, which hits him in the head, brain fragment from the skull flapping open. It's heading upwards right at that point, but then all the brain fragment goes back into the left from there. The next frame you can see, you're going back at over 1,000 feet per second per second, over 100 miles per hour, slammed into the back of the car and lifted up out of the seat. And you can clearly see the damage done, not only the flap on the right, but if you look closely to the back of the head, the hair is sticking out from the exit wound in these pictures. Back of the head is distorted. And he continues to slam backwards during this sequence, each frame, as I say, about an 18th of a second. Here you can see the pergola, and just at the end of it, standing on the little abutment to the right of the Stemmons Road sign, is Abraham Zapruder taking the pictures and his secretary holding him up so he won't fall over. You can barely see the umbrella man over the right shoulder of this individual who's in the frame to the left. And the retaining wall that runs along behind the Stemmons Road sign shows an individual standing there who is this badge man in a police uniform. And closer examination shows what appear to be people standing behind the fence as well. And I believe there were shots from up in that location, maybe the ones that hit Connolly. They were making a lot of noise. There were puffs of smoke. The witnesses heard and saw the shots there. The large majority of witnesses ran in that direction, but I don't believe that the headshot came from there. I think the reaction is to a shot from below. Kennedy was not driven down into the seat. He was lifted up out of the seat. Here's yet another picture in the same sequence. The black arrow pointed at Kennedy's head. Umbrella man much more visible by the stem and sign. And this is before the fatal shot is hit. But after Kennedy's begun to react. This is a diagram by Cutler of these weapons that were developed and that he believes there's a clear hole visible in the photos in the umbrella skin. You can have a trigger down at the point where you hold the umbrella, a CO2 cartridge that's activated up at the top, and this tiny dart or shatter disc fire out the front. So that's what Fletcher Prouty, another researcher, also saw these weapons and saw the flechettes demonstrated in the little tubes in his office. A guy came in, fired one into his wall. And it's certainly possible to aim them like you can aim anything else. It's hand-eye coordination. So I think that that's where the shot into Kennedy's throat came from. Other shots, I think, came from the top of the Dallas jail, the Daltex building, the Knoll, and the book depository. I think there were men in the other sewers, and there's even evidence of men several miles down the road. If it didn't work at Dealey, they had to call off there. They had a second team backup to hit Kennedy before he got to the trademark, standing on top of the stadium further down the way. You have pictures of guys with rifles down there. Some people were arrested in Dealey Plaza. None were named or charged or booked by the police, but they were taken down to the Dallas police station, about 12 of them. This is a photo of some of them. There are several of these. These are ones taken off a railroad car to the south side of Dealey Plaza. These are referred to as the bums or the tramps because they came out of the car, but looking closely, they have fairly good shoes and clothing. They're clean-shaven, and although their hair is mussed, it's been recently cut. These people don't look like indigents that have lived on the street when you see them up close. Significance of this particular photo, they're being taken out, three of them. You see the third guy's feet in the back. By these two Dallas policemen escorted from Dealey Plaza. And you can see to the right of the three men in the row, a guy heading the other direction. Fletcher Prouty says that that man, he can recognize him well, he worked with him for years, is General Edward G. Lansdale, a top psychological warfare expert, and the person referred to in JFK as General Y. Fletcher Prouty is the person referred to as X. He's a researcher. He worked in the Pentagon Special Operations Division, Plans Division. He was chief of special operations and military support for covert operations for many years. He knew Lansdale well. Lansdale is both a killer and a psychological warfare operator at the top levels of government secrecy. And he says he can recognize this guy that he worked with, even from the back, walking the other direction in this photo. There's ongoing attempts to identify these tramps. Early on, people tried to say they were E. Howard Hunt and Frank Sturgis. I don't believe the best evidence shows that. Fred Lee Chrisman is one person implicated. Another name that's come up over the years is Charles Harrelson, the father of Woody Harrelson from Cheers show, who's locked up for shooting a federal judge. And now there's a new group in Dallas that have named them, given them different names, Chauncey Holt, Charles Rogers. But the gunmen or the teams taken from there are not as important as the patsy, and the case can be solved without naming the gunman by following Oswald and who he is. This is Gene Hill, one of the witnesses on the south side of Elm, taking pictures, who saw things. She was dragged off forcibly and painfully by Secret Service, who took her into a closed room and threatened her to keep her mouth shut about what she saw up on the grassy knoll. Still alive, helped with the Stone film, and is writing a book about her experiences, but was harassed by the police and the FBI for many, many years. Her testimony to the Warren Commission was altered before it was entered into the record. This is a picture looking the other way, up Elm Street from the railroad overpass. The circled portion is where S.M. Holland and a number of the railroad employees watching the motorcade saw a puff of smoke come out from under the trees and other activity indicating fire up at that point. People in the motorcade smelled smoke, but smoke in that area was rising upward into the trees. And the smoke that they smelled down at Connolly's level right after the headshot, I believe, was smoke coming up out of this storm sewer. And you can't see the storm sewer very well from here, but it's just beyond the edge of that road sign, which was removed right after that. and had bullet nicks in it, but it's not the Stemmons Road sign that you see a little further up the street later on, but the sewer is across the street and it's between the place where the steps come down from the knoll, there's a series of steps, and the street lamp, it's between those two positions. This is Mr. Bowers, who worked in the railroad tower and who saw cars and strange activity, people talking to microphones and things just before the assassination, half an hour before, driving in and out of the parking lot, saw individuals standing up behind the fence, saw a flash or some activity that directed his attention behind the fence at the time of the shooting, and testified to the Warren Commission, later died in a car accident. This is the change in the route of the motorcade made 48 hours before it entered Dallas by four people at a meeting in a private oil club in Dallas, an FBI agent unidentified in the record who I believe to be Forrest Sorrells, a Secret Service agent identified as Harold Wong, a Green just out of Secret Service school, who later was in physical possession of the Watergate tapes when Sirica subpoenaed them and had moved up to the top levels of Secret Service, and two advanced public relations people from the Saul Bloom Advertising Agency named Jack Peterball and Elizabeth Forsling. And it was Elizabeth Forsling who directed that the bubble top, the weather bubble top, be taken off the limousine. And they were all involved in this illegal and unauthorized change in routing that slowed the motorcade down and made Kennedy a target. But this is, instead of going straight down Main Street, it's the double turn that slows it down, depicted in Wendy's graphic. And on the side, she has all of these witnesses that saw people or heard people firing from up on the knoll. This is yet another picture looking up the grassy knoll just a few moments after. The crowd's beginning to react. They run down the street, as you'll see in the video in a second, and run up the knoll. Some other individuals are walking the opposite direction and seemingly unaffected. On the far side, just in front of the bus of Elm Street, there's a meeting going on between Umbrella Man and a Latin individual who sit down the curb for a while and have a little bit of a discussion. The person walking the other way in front of the bus is Jim Hicks, who you see in the next photo after the bus goes down the road, changes directions, and in the back of his pocket appears to be a radio. So you look at the next slide, you can see it up close. He's the last guy toward you, and in the left pocket, there's a radio sticking out the back of the pocket and what appears to be a little antenna wire sticking off of it, and he's one of the communications men on the knoll in the kill teams. But this is crowd reaction right after, not going toward the book depository, but toward the grassy knoll. There you can see S.M. Holland, some of the men standing up on the railroad overpass who saw the smoke come from out under the trees and the fence just to the far right of the picture. More witness reaction. The Newman's on the ground. He had been in the military. They heard the shots come over their head. They hit the deck. Zapruder jumped off of the pergola. I think he's still standing there at this point, and went up and looked behind him and off to his left. He thought the shots came from behind him. A newsman's taking a picture, and I don't know who this guy is, grabbing the woman and dragging her off maybe to get her out of the way of the shots. But people in the line of fire clearly reacted to shots from the front. So let me show you now the... if you turn that off, Patrick, you should do it so the... It still has the fan on. It's probably pretty hot at this point. I'm going to show you now is a number of versions of the Zapruder film taken that day. This film was buried by Life magazine for many years. It just lasts a few seconds. These are the motorcycles turning onto Elm Street. Start to see the roadway, the sign. Here's Kennedy's car approaching the sign. Emerges and he's hit. Connolly's not yet hit. Turns to the right to see him. Turns back. Now Connolly clearly hit, and then the headshot. And Jackie climbs out on the top of the car. It'll go a little slower than the other ones, but this is Zapruder at its normal rate. And this film was buried by Life magazine. This particular one was taken out of the Life labs by Robert Groden, one of the researchers. And outside of a few frames missing right at the early part of the film, you can see the splice cut in the slower versions, seems to be an intact and very clear version of Zapruder. This is a blow-up of one segment of the frames. There's the splice cut. Connolly reacting. Kennedy slumping toward Jackie. And then the fatal headshot. Jackie climbing out on the back. So this is a little slower. I think the next sequences are witness reactions. Saw some of them in freeze frame. You'll see them actually run up the knoll and respond. One guy yells out, "Where is he? Where'd he go?" And then the next version is a rotoscope version where Grodin took a particular detail in the frame, which is Kennedy's head, and blew each frame detail up to the size of a full frame so it doesn't distort the timing. Dan Rather was one of the first few to see this film after it was made and came on TV and said the head went forward with considerable force.
The needy, and three-fourths of them had not received a mammogram before receiving it on our van.
Elma Ramos was worried when she went to the van after finding a lump in her breast. Her mammogram and other tests revealed the lump was not cancer.
Thanks. Sorry. In the film JFK, Mr. X, who comes to give Garrison the bigger picture of what's behind the assassination, asks three questions. And I think they're pertinent now because I think the Warren Commission is essentially finished as an explanation to the Warren Commission. I think the genie's out of the bottle. I think we know there were multiple assassins. And so if you have more than one assassin, you must explain motive unless you want to believe that there were several assassins out to get Kennedy on the same day at the same time, who happened to converge by chance on Dealey Plaza. But I'm willing to be called a conspiracy theorist as long as those people are willing to be called coincidence theorists. But I think a rational explanation shows it's more than one. And then you have to ask, what was the motive? And to get to the motive, you have to come to history and you have to come to politics. But he asked three questions. Who benefits? Ki Bono. Why was it done? And who has the power to cover it up? And those three questions, I think, can be answered. In the Kennedy case, the hard evidence of the case is not only of multiple gunmen, but at the topmost level of a coup d'etat that day by the United States military and the Joint Chiefs of Staff. They were people in this position to do not only the assassination of Kennedy, but the cover-up later on, as the body was taken illegally to a naval hospital. And this coup, I believe, was carried out in a very precise way, also to involve other groups, even to the level of, if you do it right, making those groups feel internally that each of them was responsible for the assassination, had carried it out, and could take credit for the assassination while you pull the strings at the top. But several of the events that happened that day, one being the fact that the phone grid in Washington, D.C., in the major offices, Department of State, Department of Agriculture, went down for a period of about 2 hours right at the time that Kennedy was killed. My mother worked in the Pentagon, five levels above top security, for 30 years, the highest paid woman employee in the DOD, civilian employee. She was told in the latter part of 1963 of a major change in policy. She knew ahead of time that they were going to withdraw from Vietnam. Her job for the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Deputy Chief of Staff for Personnel Office, was to project national draft call figures for the Joint Chiefs. And the purpose of doing that was to figure out how many people did Selective Service have to call to keep certain force levels up or down as they projected them. She had tables to tell her how many would die of natural causes or accident, how many would retire or reenlist, how many would discharge. But another section of the Pentagon, totally secret, the planning division, would come to her with figures about combat situations that were coming up and how many people would die in them, how fast they'd be escalated or not. And it was clear to her fairly early on, because she had to know those projections and do them 5 years in advance, accurate within 100 people either way for the annual national draft call. She had to know fairly early what was going on, and she knew that the plans were to begin withdrawal of advisors from Vietnam and get all the troops out of Vietnam by 1965. The thing has been contended in Peter Del Scott's work and the Gravel editions of the Pentagon Papers, more recently by Fletcher Prouty and Mr. Newman in the State Foreign Relations paper, and argued so bitterly against in the press. But in fact, even Arthur Schlesinger and others in the White House have had to admit that Kennedy was withdrawing from Vietnam. What many don't know is that on November 25th, 1963, the Monday following the assassination, when my mother went into work, she was handed the projections for a different war, a war that would last 10 years and in which 57,000 Americans would die. 2 days after the assassination is over, it's Friday, Saturday, Sunday, and then by Monday morning, they're planning and putting into effect, and she couldn't believe the figures. She took them up to the Joint Chiefs, and she said, these can't be right. Probably the first civilian protest of the war in Vietnam. I talked to Strategic Air Command bomber pilots at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. These are planes that have to be in the air in shifts for 24-hour coverage. Some go up, others come down. Some number of planes always in the air, there and at other key bases. Purpose of Strategic Air Command is immediate reaction or response to national emergency or nuclear emergency anywhere in the world. These are the planes that go up when necessary with loaded nuclear weapons, and they communicate by encrypted signals from the White House or command and control centers that are hidden under the earth at various places with the president or whoever is responsible at the point in time to be told to go to a certain location, to go to a fail-safe point, or to go beyond fail-safe, which means they're going into the actual bombing sequence for the nuclear war. This is the crux of the nuclear defense of the United States. Now, these guys were in the planes that hour when news came that Kennedy had been shot in Dallas. And their reaction was to leave the front of the plane and go to a certain locker that they kept in the plane. We had a key for that locker, and that locker included a code book, an encrypting book, that would tell them several things. The first encrypting code would tell them whether they were actually communicating with the White House or not, or the president or the official authorities. These codes were changed on a regular basis. There were 16 people that had to move them onto the plane and then off the plane, not at the same time, but they passed through 16 hands and were signed for to make sure that nothing happened in the security. And they told me that not a single pilot in the air that hour had a code book on board. Also in the plane, bringing the cabinet back from Honolulu, a major meeting planning the Vietnam War, according to Pierre Salinger's book, was devoid of a code book. Similarly, the pilots had gone for the code book when they got the news. It wasn't aboard. Now, there's not a mafia goon in New Orleans or anywhere else. There's not a CIA schlepper within Mongoose or any of the CIA covert operations. There's not a pissed off oilman in Dallas, Texas, or anywhere else that can touch those code books. Those three things together, or even separately, should tell you that this was a coup d'etat pulled off at the highest levels of military intelligence and defense control. It was the Joint Chiefs of Staff and the military-industrial complex that Eisenhower had warned about coming into power in America and taking control in the brutal murder of a president that they were never to be caught for. This was an organization known as the Defense Intelligence Agency, not the CIA, but the DIA, whose initials are not known to most people in America, even though its size and its budget is 10 times the CIA and the FBI combined. In fact, the Defense Intelligence Agency has infiltrated both of those organizations. The oldest intelligence agency in the United States is the ONI, the Office of Naval Intelligence, modeled after British Naval Intelligence. But even though it's been around that long and active for those many years, I've only found five commercially published books in any library, including the Library of Congress, that deal at all with this Office of Naval Intelligence. Oswald worked for the Office of Naval Intelligence. The original links between U.S. intelligence and the mafia was not with the CIA around the Bay of Pigs. It was in the 1940s, around the docks of New York, in Project Luciano, when Lucky Luciano was approached by Navy intelligence through Meyer Lansky and others in order to have Luciano make arrangements both to keep the docks free of sabotage and eventually to help Patton land in Sicily. And the Kieffaber Commission, which studied organized crime in the 1950s, wanted to know how Patton was able to land in this hostile Italian environment and cross 100 miles with the Third Army within a matter of days. And they discovered how because a message was sent back from Lucky Luciano to Don Caligari Vizzini, the head of the Italian mafiosi, who had been chased up into the hills by Benito Mussolini and out of power in Palermo in the cities. And Patton landed and went up into those hills and rode triumphantly into the small towns in the hills with the head of the Sicilian Mafia in the tank with him. And from that day on in World War II, a new nickname was applied to the Third Army under Patton. It was Lucky Forward. And I believe it was Lucky Luciano Forward is what they're talking about, not just Lady Luck. But they had connections initially, and then after the World War, the mob was broken off into two sections, one of which went with the CIA and ongoing covert operations, and the other of which linked closely with J. Edgar Hoover and the FBI. But some of these mobsters' ties initially started and kept up with the ONI, including a mobster named Jacob Rubenstein, or Jack Ruby, who goes back to the 1940s. When he was a kid, was a runner for the Capone mob in Chicago, and had ties. He was investigated in the waste handle union scandal with Sam Giancana in the 1950s because of racketeering. Giancana refused to testify to the McClellan Committee. He was put in jail for contempt of Congress, and then they moved to subpoena, and I looked into the McClellan Committee records, they moved to subpoena his second-in-command, Jack Ruby. And at that point, a letter arrived from the White House, from the Vice President, Richard Milhouse Nixon, telling them not to subpoena this individual, and mentioning that he had worked for many years as an informant for the Federal Bureau of Investigation and had done favors, so he was not to be bothered. The connection of these people at the top level goes back to that period. Remember, Nixon's one of the few who can't recall what he was doing that day. In addition to that, Navy intelligence trains assassins, and there's an article from the London Sunday Times reprinted on the back of the bibliography list I have over here on the long sheet about the Kennedy assassination that tells how they do it, clamping the head, making people watch pictures and inure them, their normal reactions to violence and other things. Under the DIA are all the other branch intelligences, the Army intelligence, Marine and Air Force intelligence, who throughout the 60s spied on civilians and kept files on upwards of 8 million people doing domestic operations as well as foreign under their intelligence network. Also included under DIA is the NRO, the National Reconnaissance Organization. Its name and its initials are both classified. It is the agency responsible for coordinating all the information gotten from satellites and satellite photos or satellite surveillance. Now, satellites can see in a clear day, as long as there's no cloud cover, they can see a golf ball out in a field. That's the level of resolution. They can read a license plate on a car from a satellite. They give you these nice fuzzy photos in the paper so you think that they can't see anything, but they didn't put them up there for nothing, and they know how lenses work, and they can see quite well. How are they going to see well enough to stop the ICBM coming in with a beam if they can't read where it's going, you know, along the Earth? And if they can stop an ICBM going at that speed, then they can also put a beam to stop you walking down the street. Satellites are weapons. They're also surveillance devices. And they collect all this. In fact, the agency contracting most of the Navy satellite photos and photo intelligence was Jagger Charles Stovall in the early 1960s, a place where Lee Harvey Oswald worked as a photographic expert. He knew microdot shrinking technology. He knew blow-up technology for photographs. In fact, Jagger Charles subcontracted his work out because their cameras weren't good enough to do the resolution needed in these photographs, and he moved over to an advertising agency called Sol Bloom. That's where Jack Peterborough and Elizabeth Forsling worked, where they changed the route of the motorcade. Oswald went over there 60 times subcontracting out photographic work. It was from that shop, in the very months when Oswald worked there on the photos, that the picture emerged, given by Navy intelligence then to the White House, showing missiles in Cuba, which started the Cuban Missile Crisis in 1961. Oswald was a top-ranking naval intelligence operative with crypto clearance. He was very knowledgeable. They trained him in Russian. They gave him a discharge from the Marines because a box fell on his mother's nose 9 months before. The letter documenting the swelling of her nose arrived 4 days after the discharge was issued. And then he was sent on military transport into Helsinki and into the Soviet Union as one of three phony defectors that went in under U.S. intelligence that month and returned with him when he came back a few months later. This boy was paid back in the United States, and every place that Oswald worked, he had ties to the U.S. intelligence agency. In addition to these organizations, DIA also includes the National Security Agency, the largest electronic eavesdropping agency in the world. They eavesdrop on all electronic communication in the world. They have something that machines that they, Operation Harvest, they call it. These machines can simultaneously, in a 24-hour period, tap 450,000 different telephones and all the conversations they go through. They are listened to not by agents, but by computers. These hundreds of thousands of conversations are run through at very high speed, and computers listen for key phrases or key words or repetitions of those phrases. And they begin to harvest out the ones that will bear the most fruit. So it's like a pyramid, and those conversations that come off of certain phones that seem like they might be worth listening to will eventually go to human ears. So it's not a question of, do you think your phone has tapped John Judge? All of our phones are tapped. If they can do 450,000 simultaneously in one day, they're Western, they're methodical, they just move from phone batch to phone batch until they find the conversations that tell them which phones they want to tap 24 hours a day. I hope they do tap my phone. Maybe they'll learn something. In addition to that, the largest internal police force in the United States, the Defense Industrial Security Command, is under the DIA. This was formed at the time of the Tennessee Valley Authority, the TVA, in order to guard the atomic secrets of Project Manhattan and the development of the atom bomb. After that, they were a secret, totally military, no civilian input or control police force that expanded out into guarding all the atomic energy plants, the Voice of America, the different corporate firms for the military-industrial complex have these as their special secret guards run by the military. Their headquarters in Muscle Shoals, Alabama, at Redstone Arsenal. They guarded all of the early Nazi rocket scientists when they came to the United States. At NASA, They were also later the people responsible for putting plutonium into the refrigerator and the food and the sink and the toilet of Karen Silkwood. They were guarding the Kerr-McGee plant, and what she found out and the reason why she was killed was not plant safety violations at Kerr-McGee, but that bomb-grade plutonium was being smuggled out by the DISC guards. It was going through the Mossad and then to South Africa. Whether she knew how far it went, I don't know, but it was interesting to me that one of the recent critics of the Stone film was the New York Times reporter that she was supposed to meet with the night that she was driven off the road into the bridge abutment. So these people reappear, but it was DISC that surrounded her house and that guarded the situation. And they're involved in many murders, both Lee Harvey Oswald and Jack Ruby and Bannister, Mr. Bannister and Clay Shaw, one of the key witnesses that Garrison eventually, he was a suspect as well, had connections with Defense Industry Security Command. This is the largest internal police force in the United States. There's no civilian input to the DIA. There's not even an effective congressional oversight committee. They don't even pretend like they do with the CIA to put them up for congressional. When Otis Pike's committee, looking into intelligence in the 1970s, asked the ONI to come forward and show their charter, just the legal paper on the basis of which they existed, they refused. They told him it was a matter of national security and he was not in a position to see it. He reminded them that he was on the committee that approved their funding each year. They still slapped him in the face in the beginning of the Pike testimony and said, "You're not allowed to see this. I'm sorry, sir. This is national security." So even the piece of paper on which they're based was not allowed to go into the hands of any of the Congress members. In addition to their budget that's visible in the Congress each year, there's a massive black budget of billions of dollars under the Pentagon that helps to carry on these operations. And these operations support the military end of many of the covert coups and other things that go on abroad and eventually come back home, I believe, to bear November 22, 1963, when these same forces pull off this coup with the death of Kennedy. The corporate firm that was used by the Defense Intelligence Agency in order to do the mechanic level of the killing and to do the involvement, pull the strings of these varied groups that were going to be involved in the killing, and as I say, make some of these groups feel that they themselves were responsible, was Permanent Industrial Exhibits, or Permindex. Permindex was one of 750 subsidiaries of the British American Canadian Corporation that was founded by William Donovan and Alan Dulles and William Casey. The joke with these, I mean, these people were major investors worldwide, and at the end of World War II, in charge of intelligence, they knew where the next shoe would fall. They made their investments based on it. They were tied to firms like Sullivan and Cromwell. The joke in the agency about CIA was it stood for Casey's investments abroad. All right, so they're not just spooks, they're also very rich men. They're making their profit and making their class decisions based on what they know in these intelligence circles. And they formed BACC as a way to combine British and U.S. intelligence operations worldwide under a corporate cover, and Permindex is one of those. Permindex was run out of Italy and out of Switzerland. They were eventually kicked out of Italy for their connections with U.S. intelligence. And then they moved to Montreal, Canada, and J.M. Bloomfield headed them up. Bloomfield had a long history with J. Edgar Hoover, with Sir William Stevenson, man called Intrepid, with Stevenson's second in command, Ian Fleming, who wrote the James Bond books. Ian Fleming and Stevenson had written the American Charter for the CIA back in 1946, come to the United States from British intelligence. They were the liaison from British intelligence to the FBI in World War II. And they had had these training camps, first at Oberammergau, and then later Camp X up in Montreal, to train special forces against communism. And Bloomfield headed that training camp up there. He had ties through that to the Office of Special Services during World War II, and to Clay Shaw and many other special forces. Among Permindex's subsidiaries were the International Trade Mart in New Orleans and in Dallas, where Kennedy would have eaten lunch that I showed you before, where Oswald New Orleans was passing out these leaflets. Clay Shaw sat on the board of Permindex from its inception in the 1940s. And in addition to that was Centro Commerciale Mondiale, an Italian company linked into the BACC and Permindex net. That was the corporation that built the Watergate complex in the United States and did the contracting out for that building where Nixon was later scandalized out of office due to operations that were done there. Under Permandex, then, five groups were operated under their control in order to do the mechanical level of funding and carrying out the assassination of John F. Kennedy. First of those groups was a group called the Syndicate. It's not the whole mob or the whole criminal syndicate. It was based in Miami and Havana, and it ran gambling operations between those two cities. It included Bobby Baker, who was scandalized during the LBJ years, Cliff Jones, who was for some time Democratic National Committeeman, Murray Chotiner, a hatchet man for Richard Milhouse Nixon, who took Nixon to gambling down in Havana in the 1940s and tied him into both FBI and mob operations. Nixon was a longtime naval intelligence operative himself. At the end of the war, he worked at Jay Gould's castle to bring Nazis into the United States and cover their tracks. This syndicate group was also in direct support of taking Castro out of power and putting in Mr. Sicaris, Prio Sicaris, who would have reestablished the mob gambling casinos down there in Cuba, and was tied ultimately to the CIA mafia plots, ostensibly for that purpose, but the creation of assassination teams against Castro, I think, basically were domestic assassination teams, and Castro was the given excuse. But the mongoose group that's depicted in the film, they are still, I believe, smoke and not fire in terms of who actually killed Kennedy. But these anti-Castro Cubans had been a standing mercenary army from the time they came in the United States to work for the intelligence agencies, carried out assassinations and other types of covert operations. When Bernard Barker testified in the Watergate Committee, they asked him how long it had been since you'd seen Eugenio Martinez and these other Cubans you used in the break-in at the Watergate Hotel. He said, well, we worked together in the Bay of Pigs. They were my team. They said, well, how long had it been since you were in touch with them? He said, about 10 years. They said, how long did it take you to locate them or find them? He said, oh, maybe 20 minutes. These people are there, they're on order, they're under employ, and they're contracted out, and they're ready to go. They have these two organizations, Alpha 66 and Omega 7. They're rabid anti-communists, anti-Castroites, and they're still planning now for a reinvasion of Cuba. The second group then was the larger circle of these anti-Castro Cubans, especially the Cuban Democratic Revolutionary Front and the Cuban Revolutionary Council that involved E. Howard Hunt from the CIA, Mr. Frawley from New Orleans, who financed them, Frank Sturgis, who showed up later in Watergate, but also testified to the Warren Commission, telling them that Castro did it, the 5306 Brigade that was part of the Bay of Pigs operation and the Bay of Pigs survivors, who were financed by and helped by Cuban Aid Relief. Cuban Aid Relief was a special fund created from the Catherwood Foundation in Pennsylvania, out of Philadelphia, Cummins Catherwood. He knew Ian Fleming and was familiar with the real James Bond who lived there. Mr. Catherwood also financed the building of a Russian Orthodox church, even though he lived in Philadelphia, in Dallas, Texas. And that church in Texas was where the white Russian community came to meet Lee Harvey Oswald. Mr. de Morenshield, a Nazi spy and a white Russian count, brought the Oswalds into this church community to meet Paines, Michael and Ruth Paine, Ray Gorodsky, Bowie, the other people from the Tolstoy Foundation, which is CIA financed, but the church was built by Mr. Catherwood, who also financed Cuban Aid Relief to help out the survivors of the Bay of Pigs. Another group financing this circle, financial angel for Hunt's group, Cuban Revolutionary Council, was Mr. William Riley of the Riley Coffee Canning Company, where Oswald supposedly worked as an oiler, although he got off 2 hours a day to go do what he wanted. They said his job was to go around and oil things. Within 2 weeks after the assassination, the Riley Coffee Canning Company folded operations, and the bosses for Oswald and the other people who worked with him on the line went over and got a job at NASA, the National Aeronautics and Space Administration. Now, I don't know how you go from coffee canning to NASA, you know, you're back.